Welcome to What's Killing My Kale. This is a podcast from University of Minnesota Extension all about integrated pest management tactics for vegetable and fruit producers. I'm Annie Claude, and I'm an Extension Educator here for fruit and vegetable production.
And I'm Natalie Hoytel, an Extension Educator with the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Education team.
Welcome back to What's Killing My Kale. This week we're talking with Bill Hutchison, an Extension IPM expert who specializes in insects. We're going to do a wrap-up of the 2018 growing season. So, Bill, can you introduce yourself?
I'm Bill Hutchison. I'm an Extension entomologist with University of Minnesota and Extension, and have now been in Minnesota about 29 winters, originally from Arizona, but really grown to enjoy the change of seasons here in Minnesota. Raised a family here, and really enjoy working with growers of fruit and vegetable crops, especially.
So you work as our IPM specialist with fruit and vegetable growers?
Right.
So what are some of the big insect pressures that you have seen this summer?
So for this past year, 2018, the dominant pest issues, insect pests that I work with, that we've had to work with, are actually three of our most recent invasive species to the state, attacking both fruit and vegetable crops, primarily fruit crops to start with, spotted wing Drosophila, the fruit fly, that we actually first detected in 2012, is still a dominant pest issue of concern for a lot of growers, especially berry growers, and the brown marmorated stink bug is another insect that came into the state, first detected in 2010. It's been developing its population levels at a much slower rate, thankfully, for growers, but it nevertheless is also increasing. Our trap catches are increasing for that one. And then Japanese beetle. I think almost everybody in the state, everyone I've talked to seems to know what a Japanese beetle looks like, from the homeowners to backyard gardeners to community gardens in the Twin Cities metro especially, and then commercial growers. And the issue with all three of these pests is just a huge wide host range of not only wild hosts where they can maintain themselves, whether it's wild raspberries for SWD, spotted wing Drosophila, or Japanese beetle feeding on roses and linden trees and then moving into some of our key crops. So those three insects are getting a lot of my attention, and we have graduate students also doing research on these three insects. So all three played a big role again in 2018.
So we have already had episodes on SWD and on Japanese beetle, but we haven't heard a whole lot yet about Japanese or about brown marmorated stink bug on this podcast. Can you just talk a little bit about, like, when did you start seeing it? What are all of the crops that it's affecting?
Sure.
What kind of damage are you seeing?
Right. And so again, it's in the world of entomology, the brown marmorated stink bug is what we call a true bug just because of its shape and the size of the antennae and morphology. But, you know, anyone can sort of do a Google search on stink bugs in general, but brown marmorated, there's plenty of images that one can look at on the web. And to help identify it, I would encourage people to go right away to our Fruit Edge website. If you just Google Fruit Edge, that'll come up through our department, through Extension. But in terms of its life cycle, life history, it clearly will complete one full generation a year. Our research is showing that it may also complete a partial generation in the fall. This time of year, September, October, as we're finishing up the season, we can get additional adults coming out. And that is problematic, for example, with our recent vineyard, our grape growers, grapes for winemaking, as well as even right now on October 2nd, as we discuss this today, for some of our apple growers. So any apple varieties that are still out there that need to be harvested can be at risk to the sneak bug. But basically, it overwinters as an adult. Homeowners and the general public in the state, like some of our other insects, it also, the stink bug likes to overwinter in people's homes. So we get a lot of calls every year in the fall as this insect is looking for a home to overwinter. They may find your home. They may find your farm buildings too. They are seeking shelter because our research to date has shown that it's likely very difficult for this insect to survive outdoors in our harsh Minnesota winters. So we did have a grad student work on this for a PhD. A lot of data supports that, that they really need to seek warmer protected shelters to overwinter. But they do overwinter as adults. We see them now coming out in April and May in the spring. And then they mate as soon as they emerge in the spring. After about a week and a half to 2 weeks, they will mate and then start laying eggs and restart the life cycle again with egg lay and nymphs hatching in May, June, and July, and then moving through the season. So again, a wide variety of crops from soybeans in the field crop world to sweet corn at harvest, again, damaging the kernels and kernel quality in sweet corn. But then I'm really concerned about many of our fruit crops, especially wine grapes and raspberries, blueberries, eventually being attacked. But quick answer, long answer to this short question is that the good news with brown marmorated stink bug is that they're still at very low levels in the state. So we do have a good pheromone baited trap, sticky trap that we can use to monitor. We're also working with the Department of Ag in Minnesota and actually Wisconsin, collaborating with them to monitor, especially in our apple orchards that are along the St. Croix River Valley.
And you're publishing that scouting data on Fruit Edge?
Any pest alerts, we make those available on Fruit Edge.
Okay. So how far do stink bugs travel? Is this a situation where you could do really good indoor pest control over the winter and kind of reduce your problems, or would you still have stink bugs coming in?
Well, we're pretty sure that homeowners can help us out a little bit by killing those insects inside their homes during the winter that might help reduce the spring emergence the next year. Is that completely going to solve the problem? No, but everything helps. And so we do have some homeowners that are cooperating with us and putting traps out actually in their backyards for us to evaluate some new traps, and that's gone well this year. So we hope to do more of that next year. With all of these invasive species, they have fairly quick reproductive cycles. The females lay a lot of eggs per female. And so the idea of completely eradicating these pests, including the stink bug, is not realistic.
As growers potentially anticipate pressure from brown marmorated stink bug next year, what are some management techniques that they can be thinking about or kind of preparing for?
So the first thing that they should think about is putting one of these traps out on their farm so they have the local information to know, is the stink bug present at all? And if so, what levels? Are they relatively low to moderate levels?
Where can someone get one of those traps?
So there's at least two different suppliers that we like to use. Great Lakes IPM out of Michigan is one of our suppliers that we use. And these are just recently becoming available commercially following the research that we've done to show that this sticky panel trap, about the size of your laptop screen, is the most effective trap and easy to move around from a logistics point of view, set up two or three on a farm. And the pheromone lure has also really improved over the last few years. So we feel good about the lure. that the lure, like with a lot of our insect species, it's actually mimicking the sex pheromone that females use to attract males for mating in many species. And so it's a two-component or dual lure that we like. And we, this winter, will be making this information available on the Fruit Edge website as well. We have a new fact sheet that we just completed on brown marmorated stink bug. So that will be up on our website soon.
So if people find that they do have stink bugs, what are you recommending? Is it mostly chemical right now? Are there any organic management options, biocontrol?
Right. So right now, if we know that if with these traps, if we're just catching one or two adult stink bugs per week, which is sort of the max to date that we've found in Minnesota, that's probably not going to be a major issue for most of these crops. We are still working on, you know, economic injury levels or action thresholds. What is a treatable threshold to be concerned about, depending on the crop? But for example, we've only found a few adults in soybeans and just a few soybean fields in the entire state. So we got 7 million acres of soybeans. It is clearly not reaching economic levels there. Mm-hmm. But when we get to the fruit crops, higher value per acre, we still need to do the research on that to have a better handle on what the thresholds are. Michigan populations of the stink bug have really taken off the last few years, and so they're in a better position to do that type of research. But we do have one grad student here who's starting to look at it in apples, and which, because we also see varietal differences, so it really depends on varieties with the stink bug as well as some of these other pests.
Okay. Sounds like we'll have updates in
so
months and
bottom
years
line is we need more research. I'm hoping this winter to get updates from Michigan State on thresholds, especially in apples, because I know apple growers are concerned.
So let's shift gears a little bit, talk about Japanese beetle.
Okay.
I know you listened to the recent episode about it. Is there anything you want to add to that?
I guess thanks for doing that with Dominique Abenga, grad student in my lab, and Jeff Hahn, I think provided a nice overview. I think as we really start to do more research with Japanese beetle as a pest issue concern in fruit crops and with apples, the first thing that stands out that might be a little bit different from the urban grower environment is that we do see some big differences in varietal preferences. With apples, for example, unfortunately, we've seen the Japanese beetle definitely likes Honeycrisp apples just as much as we do. So, we don't have a lot of natural post-plant resistance going on with Honeycrisp. And a lot of growers obviously have plant several varieties. So what we're hoping to do is, starting in 2019, is collect more data on varietal preferences in apples, as well as raspberries, to some extent blueberries, and some of these other crops. So Prelude, for example, is raspberry, summer raspberry variety that we found this past year at one of our cooperating farms. And I'll just mention Kevin Edberg's name at the Berry Patch Farm near Forest Lake, he was very generous in letting us invade his farm this year to do a lot more research on Japanese beetle. Very useful. And he has two raspberry varieties side by side, Prelude and Nova. And that was a classic case where we saw a clear preference by the Japanese beetle for Prelude, but less so on Nova.
Okay.
It's not 100%, it's not 100%, 0%, but there's still a very clear difference. We also collected some preliminary data and followed up by bringing leaves from these two varieties into the lab in a large petri dish, replicated setting, and actually were able to verify that preference, innate preference, even in the lab. When given a choice, right, the Beatles will go to Prelude versus Nova. We're excited to have a new grad student working on this in more detail next year. Dominique Ebenga is going to be transitioning from SWD to Japanese Beatles, so we can really pursue this in more detail. So that's the biggest thing. The other thing with Japanese beetle that I think is a little bit different from maybe an urban setting is that with larger commercial fields, et cetera, is that we did put out some of the commercial, we evaluated some of the commercial traps for Japanese beetle, and we did verify that, yes, they are very effective, they're very attractive to... efficient in attracting hundreds or even thousands of Japanese beetles per week to these traps. And the concern that we've always heard about is obviously you don't want to put the trap in the middle of your field. You don't even want to put it adjacent to your field of raspberries or whatever, because you will attract thousands of beetles to that spot in the field, and they can spill over. The trap can only hold so many. They'll spill over and cause some damage. Yes, that is a concern. However, I do see the value in early detection, the early detection value of these traps, and just simply place them 50 yards, 50 meters away from your field site, so you can still get that on-farm indicator of when the Japanese beetles are coming out, and the relative population numbers that you can get in these traps can be useful, and they should be. They need to be checked at least twice a week, 2 to 3 times a week. But using the traps as well as our in-field observations this year, we were able to confirm again we had beetles at our Rosemont station just southeast of the cities. We had beetles coming out by mid-June. We still had beetles active at the end of September, and it's just one generation a year. So it's a very extended beetle emergence period. It basically covers most of our production cycle for all these crops. It's taken 50 years. It did not just arrive, you know, this decade or 5 years ago. It's actually been in the state for over 50 years. It's taken this long for it to reach these damaging population levels. And so we do have some new grants funded to start working on not only how to manage it or control it in some of these crops, but just its basic life cycle and life history. Very little work has actually been done on the adults, once the adults emerge and what they do in terms of their behavior, how far they fly, how they colonize these crops. So we learned a lot this year in just first year preliminary data. The edge effect is something that a lot of growers, I think, have noticed. When you first see the infestations building in a raspberry field, for example, usually they'll just hit the first 2 or 3 rows. And I think from a management standpoint, it might be wise for growers to think about if you have either a conventional insecticide or organic insecticide that you can use to just spray those outer edge rows. You can save a lot of pesticide, or reduce your pesticide use, reduce the cost of the spray and the hassle, maybe by just slowing them down a bit by hitting those edge rows rather than waiting until the entire field is colonized. So just looking at their behavior, their basic behavior and life cycle, that's our key to really developing an IPM program. And when I say that, integrated pest management program, I still think IPM is highly relevant. And many of the principles of IPM, of knowing the life cycle of the insect and then developing all possible complementary tactics using biological control where we can, knowing host plant resistance or knowing pest resistant varieties that you can use, We really, the goal of all of this research is to try to build a foundation of all possible management tactics and then only use insecticides when necessary. So I just want to make sure everyone's clear on my philosophy in approaching these pests. But that takes more time to learn and understand and document what their life histories are on these crops. So does that make sense? So that's what we're going for. With Japanese beetle, there was something else I wanted to mention. A side note on management, one of the alternatives to insecticides that we found, again, with just a few years of research, is that the Japanese beetle adults do not appear to really like the high tunnel environment. So especially on warmer days, and especially where standard poly plastic is over the top, and even with high tunnels where the ends are open for logistical reasons, whatever growers have, they're not always completely enclosed. We have found that and this was really part of our spotted wing Drosophila research when we set up our experimental high tunnels, et cetera. But not only are the high tunnels probably a good way to go for SWD, but we're seeing also benefits of suppressing or eliminating Japanese beetles under these high tunnels. For whatever reason, they prefer to be out on sunny days, warmer days. They like the open canopy of an open field setting versus the high tunnels. So we'll be talking about, new results like this at our winter educational meetings. And I just want to mention the Upper Midwest Fruit and Vegetable meeting that we have with our Minnesota Fruit and Veg Growers Association every year in January. I think it's about January 17th, 18th this year in St. Cloud. It's a really good meeting for growers to put on their calendar, think about attending, and we'll have a lot more updates there. We also have more graduate students giving talks this year about their specific research areas on all of these pests. Okay.
Should we just quickly talk about spotted wing Drosophila as well? That's another
sure,
one that we did
sure.
a whole extensive podcast earlier in the season, but if there are some things you learned over the
right.
summer that you want
that's
to share.
Right, and we are working with Mary Rogers in horticulture on a variety of spotted wing Drosophila control tactics or management strategies. Probably still, rightly or wrongly, the primary control option right now is still scouting by either watching these flies in your crop, which is doable, but also putting out at least one or more of the SWD traps. The lures that we have for the SWD traps, trap design, both the Century and the Trace A traps work pretty well. We like Century a little bit better for a variety of reasons based on our data. But they both work pretty well at both detecting the first adults coming in to your crops in late spring, early summer, which is basically late May to mid-June, typically, as well as monitoring the populations through the season. And the traps are not perfect. But all traps are relative, but they do give us a good indication of overall population levels, whether that's an increase, a decrease, whatever. SWD is another insect that does not really like super hot weather. It really does best at high temperatures between basically 55 to 75. Once we get over 80 or especially 85 degrees, they really do not like the heat, and they'll really just shut down in field settings and move out of. They'll actually, we've been documenting and others have documented this, how they will move in and out of a raspberry field, for example. If you have a forest edge or a wood line next to a raspberry field, We will, especially during the heat of the summer, we will detect higher numbers of SWD in the traps along the wood line or in the forest edge than we will in the raspberries. So they like the shady, cooler environments, basically, as adults. So when we do have those super warm days, that actually helps us with our control programs because there's simply just fewer adults in the field at certain times actively laying eggs in the berries. That said, because of the biology of this pest, it's a super high, it's a fast life cycle of only 10 to 14 days, typical summer temperatures in the field from egg to adult. The females mate quickly. Within a day, they'll start laying eggs. Average fecundity rates are estimated anywhere from 400 to 500 eggs per female. So you quickly can go from just a few adults in a trap to exponential increase in population growth and a lot of damage. And so in open field settings, again, the species of berry that you're growing makes a huge difference. Varieties make a big difference. But when we look across the spectrum of the berry crops, for example, we know raspberries are the number one preferred host because of the soft skin. All of the soft skin fruit species are most susceptible because it's easier for the female fly to insert her ovipositor and lay eggs. And what's unique about this species, again, is that ovipositor has a serrated edge. It's a serrated knife going through the skin of the fruit to lay eggs directly. And then once those eggs are in the berry and the larvae start hatching and feeding, there's nothing you can do. It's too late. So when we think about control tactics, it's all about understanding the biology of the adults, how quickly they mate, how far they move, when they're in the crop, when they're in the woods, all of that comes into play. But the bottom line is right now, until we have some really good biological control options, which we don't have right now in the U.S., mm-hmm. really, we're looking at insecticide sprays to control the adults before they mate and lay eggs. Or what I really like is the screen mesh netting systems that we can use to just simply exclude SWD, using a high tunnel, modifying high tunnels with screen mesh.
Yeah, so we did a whole interview with Mary about screen mesh earlier in the year, but you have this sort of proposed hybrid option, right, to kind of decrease the cost of doing that.
Yeah, so we've, and it's similar, it's one of the treatment options or hybrid options that we've looked at Rosemont in our replicated research trials, where we have the standard poly over the top, and then we put the screen mesh on the ends of our experimental high tunnels. Our high tunnels are only about 12 to 14 feet long, so they're not huge, but they're big enough to have raspberry plants in there and get our harvest data, et cetera, and evaluate control. And then we compare that to the open field plots. And what we found is in the open field plots, it might take 8 to 10 insecticide sprays on fall raspberries, which is the most susceptible, vulnerable crop to SWD. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the high tunnels, depending on the year, we either don't spray at all and get 99% control, or we might have to spray once or twice if a few SWDs accidentally get into the high tunnels. But the bottom line is, the good news, bad news with the mesh is that, yes, it's obviously can be very effective. This is an 80 gram mesh size that we use. It has to be a small enough mesh to exclude a super tiny fruit fly, okay, that's only an eighth of an inch or long, little over an eighth of an inch. So it has to be that small mesh size. Because of that, it is more expensive product. and it's still in the $4,000 to $5,000 per acre range if you were to buy mesh to cover an entire acre, depending on what your framing structure to support it is. So I like the poly plastic over the top, which holds up, by the way, hold up well against hail and rain, heavy rainfall. And then putting the mesh either on the sides and or the ends of a tunnel for that final exclusion that we need. And we've so most of our work has been done with raspberries, very promising results, but it's for growers, depending on their operation, it's getting over that initial shock and sticker shock of the capital investment that they have to make. But I think in the long run, especially for organic growers who can't use a lot of these a lot of the insecticides that work well, the pyrethroids, for example, or SWD, are restricted use pesticides. They're also not organic certified. So for organic growers especially, and I wanted to take time for this, is they really have a limited number of materials. Now, Entrust is one of the organic certified products that we know works well for SWD. And Grandivo is another one that, depending on the trial, looks pretty good with some of the data that I've seen from Michigan State, for example. But the options are really limited, are more limited for organic growers. It's always been a problem, a challenge. So I think for organic growers, also if they can get that higher premium price for their produce, especially with these berry crops, then I think it's a different business model to think about. I really encourage growers to say, to realize, I don't have to buy this for all 5 acres or 10 acres. Let's buy it for a half an acre or a third of an acre just to get started and try it in 2019 as one option. The other thing, just real quick, that I do want to mention is there's one of the challenges. The reason why the price is high is that there's very few suppliers to date. New York State has a supplier, but I want to point out that we do have a business out of Detroit Lakes that started making this available. Ag Resource Inc. in Detroit Lakes. Just do a Google search and you get to their website. They're one of the bigger sources of varieties, like strawberry varieties, raspberry varieties, but they started making the mesh available this past year, and they will also be at the Upper Midwest Fruit and Veg Conference. So at least, we may have more suppliers down the road. I did want to mention this is not just theory, but we do have a commercial source now in Minnesota out of Detroit Lakes. So they will be at the trade show as well for the fruit and veg meeting in St. Cloud. So another reason to come to the meeting and check that out. And growers can see what the mesh looks like, talk about the deep. I'm not the source for the actual cost per acre. We just know the rough estimate is $4,000 to $5,000. Maybe the prices will come down, hopefully, as we go into next year.
So one piece of SWD management is just keeping a really clean field, like getting overripe fruit
Correct.
Out of the field.
Correct.
And so something that I came across this summer with some growers is that they're doing a really good job of cleaning up the fields, but then they have to put that produce somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so one particular grower was digging a hole and kind of putting all of it in a hole
mm-hmm.
about a mile away. And then spraying that hole, which technically is an off-label application, but
right.
Do you have any suggestions for if people are doing a really good job of keeping sanitary fields, how to handle that produce that potentially has eggs in it already?
So when I hear about a grower also spraying over that hole, that is a grower who's definitely concerned. But here's I'll offer a modification.
Mm-hmm.
of that approach? And this is a really good question because it comes up with the pick your own options, business model, especially where you have the public coming through and harvesting fruit and maybe knocking some fruit off the plants and then, of course, leaving it on the ground level. Picking up that fruit, however that's done, with an army of high school students, however you do that, what I would suggest is putting that fruit in black plastic bags, like large garbage bags, and then sealing that bag well, but then letting it just sit outside for a while in the heat with the sunlight, which will gradually cook the larvae, whatever larvae are in those berries. And then, after 4 or 5 days of the direct sunlight and cooking, then those bags could be buried and, 12 inches deep or however deep you want to go, just to be sure. And maybe there's some biodegradable black plastic bags that could be used for that as well, if you're concerned about too much plastic, which would be a valid question. So that's what I would do. Again, it depends on the size of your operation. Some of our large growers with high tunnels, one of our cooperators is the Untides, Jerry Untide and his operation. They do a great job of this. So they've allowed us to invade their farm for on-farm research as well. But they, within the tunnels, they use the black landscaping material. They lay that down between the rows, and they have someone who comes through and sweeps up. It's when you have that as your surface versus straight soil, then they can come. I've heard stories of people vacuuming. I'm not sure we need to go to that extreme, but at least sweeping up those berries. And just having somebody dedicated to that, depending on how many tunnels you've got. And his tunnels are like 500 feet, I believe, the huge commercial size. So that's doable. And they have other reasons in their production system for having that black, it's not plastic, but it's the landscaping material that allows water to go through. But I think it helps maybe with some of their disease management as well. So, yeah, those are all options.
That's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.